We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange and the Pacifica Network for use by college and community radio stations worldwide. Find us wherever you listen to podcasts and at worldoceanobservatory.org.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 10:59 a.m. Next up is the Dirtbag.
Here we are, the second Wednesday of the month, post-pandemic, or almost post-pandemic, so Jim and I are live in the studio.
It's amazing, amazing. Where's the cake and ice cream?
Oh, yes. Well, we had that last month. Yes, I am Glenn Andreessen, here beside you now until 12 noon, and beside me is Jim Gilbert, live in the studio.
I remember last time, Glenn, I was recovering from COVID, which I caught in Australia, and you had your own little bout with it, too.
Yes, I did, but I've tested negative twice now, so.
Well, it's sure nice not to think that you're going to die, which
yes.
3 years ago would have been a whole different deal. So.
Our friend loaned us a oxygen device, you know, you put your finger in to tell you how much oxygen is doing, and that was very telling. And because I was down to, you know, normally I tested this morning again, too, and I was 100 or 99%, and I was down to 96.
Wow.
During that time. So, you know, I guess I was affected. Yeah, yep, but we're back in action here, so glad to do that here. We appreciate Ty coming in to act as our board operator once again, and we appreciate that, Ty. A full show, as usual, but we always make time for your phone calls if you have one. 503-231-8187. We will have a new garden stumper at half past the hour. Before that, we'll be talking about honeyberry, our plant of the month. And also, maybe talk a little bit about, you know, what I call this heat whiplash from 60 to 90 in 72 hours. How that might affect your plants and certainly the potted plants. We'll talk about that a little bit more. And in the second half of the hour, we will talk about the fruit bloom that we think is just astounding this year. Maybe somebody else has mentioned that. Let us know what you're observing in your neighborhood. And we'll also talk about the weed and grass competition. It's good to get a hold of that or take care of that early, if possible. Mm-hmm. It just makes it a lot easier there.
Grass love not having to compete with the grass.
Yep. And if you're still wondering about how you're going to trellis your kiwi or grapes or even green beans, we'll talk some about trellising. I'll mention here that what's annoying me this month, because of these darn mass shootings that continue to happen, is that I just get so annoyed when I hear a politician say, when people want to talk about gun control or something, they'll say, well, this is not the time. And I would like to hear them say, we'll pick that up in a month or 3 weeks, or be specific about when they will talk about it. Or are they just saying that to get rid of a reporter or a constituent. But anyway, that annoys me on many levels.
Yep.
But first, we will talk about a celebration, and a well-deserved celebration that's going to happen at the Capitol later this month.
Yes, Glenn, this is it really is amazing. 50 years ago, on May 23rd, the Oregon passed a bill called Senate Bill 100, which basically was a groundbreaking measure, unique in the nation, still unique in many ways. And what it did was it established urban growth boundaries, among other things, it established urban growth boundaries around cities so that urban sprawl would not affect our farmland. And it hasn't been perfect, but it has done a pretty darn good job. And so this is the month that we celebrate the 50th anniversary of that bill. And there's a celebration on the 24th of May at the Capitol Mall down in Salem. Don't know much about it. I think it starts at noon, but then there's going to be some music and different stuff going on. And you probably know I'm working on a documentary to celebrate this anniversary. It will hopefully be done in end of July, early August, talking about the history and the people who were involved in it and what's happening now. There's a lot of important reasons to get involved and to think about this, because this really has a lot to do with the state that we live in and how wonderful it is. And I just can't talk enough about it, really.
Well, you're gonna say a lot in your documentary, presumably. Actually, I don't know if we're going to hear your voice or not.
Well, I'll have a little bit in there, but yeah, there's so many other people whose voices were so powerful and so important, and, you know, some are with us. Some people who were involved then are still with us, some have passed. But you know, it is an amazing story and continues to this day.
Yeah. I think it's being chipped at a little bit, but...
we're trying our best to, you know, keep that chipping to a minimum.
Right. Well, good job, and I'm sure we'll be talking more about the documentary as it nears its final stages.
Yeah, and also, you know, I think a while back I mentioned that I've created this little flyer, this little handout that talks a little bit about this, about some of this historical stuff and what's going on now. And any listener who would like to get a copy, you can email me at jim@northwoodsnursery.com. And I will put one in the mail to you.
All right. Okay, thank you. We don't have any other events that people wrote into about, although I did present last night a Zoom presentation to the Multnomah County Master Gardeners Group, and they mentioned they have a plant sale coming up this weekend called the Incredible Edibles Sale. And rather than go and wait and whatever, you go online early and order, and then you'll just pick them up there. But I believe the deadline for ordering is today. So if you can get more information at the Multnomah County Master Gardeners Association website, which I don't know what it is, but you can find it quite easily, I'm sure. So, and with this weather, this is the time you can plant anything now, I would argue, even the warm season crops, because for another week is in the today's in forecast to be in the 70s, but then it's the 80s, 90s, and 80s for the extended forecast. So,
corn, tomatoes, peppers, all that sort
of stuff. It could go in. Those are considered warm season crops. And okay, so that's that. Let's start with continue with our plant of the month, honeyberry. And Jim sent a nice photo that I've posted on the website, and it doesn't look like what you might, at least what I might think when you say honeyberry.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you'd think golden, whatever, but...
dripping with something.
Yeah.
Well, when I was thinking about having this as the plant of the month, there's a history to this that I'd like to just share for just a moment, too, because honeyberry is a member, it's actually a member of the honeysuckle family, and most honeysuckles are not edible, but this one is, and... I discovered it in 1990 when I took my first overseas trip in my life, which was to the Soviet Union, and ended up at the Botanic Garden in Kiev, Ukraine. And there was this, they did this demonstration for us and the other Americans that were with me, all these unusual fruit. what I'd never seen before, and this was one of them.
Uh-huh.
And they, in that botanic garden, they had, it's not native to that region, but they had different parts of the garden devoted to different parts of the Soviet Union, which was really cool. And so, anyway, I was so impressed with this, with both eating the fruit, enjoying the fruit, and seeing what an attractive plant it was, that we imported some varieties. And then we learned more about it, learned about the regions that it's happy in. It's very actually quite popular on the island of Hokkaido in Japan. And there's kind of two different forms we discovered. So in Siberia, in the eastern part of Russia, they have fairly early blooming ones for us, because their spring comes so late there that they bloom in May, which would be fine for us, but unfortunately here, because our springs come earlier, they bloom very early, and there's not much in the way of pollinators around to do the work. So we start focusing our efforts on the later blooming ones,
uh-huh.
and that's the ones that are primarily offered locally, as far as I know.
When is their bloom period here?
Well, it's late March, mid to late March.
Typically. Okay.
Uh-huh. And it's still fairly early, but by then, there's bees around and things. And bumblebees really are one of the major pollinators of it, actually. It's interesting.
Well, I know with if it's a member of the honeysuckle, they have rather deep flowers, and bumblebees have relatively longer tongues, mm-hmm. so they can get to the reward, the nectar.
Oh,
they can reach it, so maybe that's why they're more attractive than other bees.
Yeah. Well, the flowers are small, and then the fruit ripens about the same time as strawberries.
Hmm.
And as you saw in the photograph, it's a blue fruit, kind of like a blueberry, very high in antioxidants. It's funny, when I first started growing the plant, there were some varieties that I had that they had bitterness to them, and I thought, oh, that's weird. That's not going to be very popular. My Russian friend said, oh, well, that's because, we think that's really good for you,
Oh.
And, I thought, well, I don't know if that's going to sell.
Yeah, right.
my customers, so we rapidly moved past the bitter ones. But there's some varieties that the names that we gave. So another thing interesting about the plant is the name, honeyberry. It didn't have a name when I first found it.
Oh.
It was, some people called it blue honeysuckle, but it was really not known in this country. And we kind of introduced it.
I see.
And,
well, why did you choose honey? Just because of the
honeysuckle.
Uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah, not because it tasted like honey.
Or it looks like honey, or right. What's the flesh color?
It's blue.
Blue too. Okay.
Yeah. And when I traveled, in 1997, I traveled to Siberia and Eastern Russia with a retired professor from Oregon State, Maxine Thompson, and she was looking for a new project for herself. So she was interested in this plant and wanted to do some breeding work with it, and she brought back material and seeds and so forth, and did some breeding in the Corvallis area with it. But she, it's funny, because she decided she wanted to have a different name, and the Japanese name for it is Hascap. And so that's what she called it. So there's a little sometimes confusion, because people will talk about Hascap, but that name doesn't really ring any bells
yeah,
to me.
Yeah.
And I'd already called it honeyberry, so that's
all
what
right.
we call it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they grow well around here.
They grow well. And the varieties, like, there's like Blue Moon is one that I actually brought back from Kiev. It was a man named Sergei Rizhov who had studied the plant, and he turned me onto that one. Blue Velvet is another one that's really nice. It's got velvety like leaves, very attractive, ornamental as well as good fruit. Then we had some that we selected from our own seedlings, Blue Hokkaido, Blue Mist, and I think One Green World has virtually all of those in their catalog. So,
okay. Thank you, Jim. That's honeyberry. Honeyberry. You can go to the Kebu website on today's Dirtbag Show, and you can see a photo of it. A very nice photograph, by the way, Jim.
Thanks.
Well, let's take a musical break here, and I'd like to set up the theme, which I think is kind of fun in honor of King Charles III's, whatever that was called, coronation. Yes. Well, I thought that we might then take a look at three kings. The first being Freddie King, an old blues man who co-wrote this, one of my favorite songs of all time, I believe, called San Jose. I hate to plot that one down, but we got a show to go.
That's right.
So that's our first king. Stay tuned for the second and third coming up.
Great.
Yeah, another great version of that is by Ronnie Earl. Ronnie Earl and the Broadcasters. Check it out.
I think we need more kings, really. I mean, it's, you know, the world used to have a lot of them. Now I think we've only got, you know, is Charles the only king?
Well, there might be some in Scandinavia. In Saudi Arabia? I don't know. Why do you think we need more of them, Jim?
Well, we need to make it more available. You know, people should, you know, they can earn kingness somehow.
Yes.
You know,
not just being born to it.
That's right. And then people might be more happy about it. You know, we could.
Well, we sometimes we call them presidents, but.
Yeah.
Earning it, right?
Earning that, right.
Okay, well, let's move on here then. We'll come back to that king theme, though. Okay, so we got this here on Wednesday. We're expecting mid-70s today, and then maybe 70s, and then 80s and 90s over the weekend. My mother's 92, and it might be that hot on Mother's Day, and I'll see her. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go down and see her in Eugene.
Nice.
Both my folks. Dad's 93. Maybe he'll be there on Monday when it's 93. So what's it going to do to our plants, Jim? I mean, anything that you think we should do? I mean, other than make sure they have plenty of water.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if your plant's in a pot, of course, you want to make sure that that's going to be more critical water-wise than a plant in the ground. The ground moisture right now is really high, so
yeah.
There's not going to be any issues with that. And, you know, some plants are more sensitive to hot sun than others, but there's not a whole lot one can do about it.
Yeah.
At this point, you know, if you're, I don't think it's going to cause any super amount of damage. It's just, you know, so maybe some leaf burn on some things mm-hmm. that are just starting to leaf out.
And I'm wondering if, you know, if people do, gardeners put out their plant, their tomatoes or something like that, maybe they should put a shade, you know, a piece of wood or something just to provide some shade there from 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock.
Yeah. For vegetables, it's a different deal because a lot of times you're planting out pretty succulent young plants that, you know, they would not be happy.
And this brings up a very important technique and procedure called hardening off, mm-hmm. which is very important if you're coming out of a cushy greenhouse environment. They need to go outside for you know, 15, 20, 30 minutes the first day, and then put them back in, and then bring them out for an hour the next day, or so on and so forth.
Yeah, if you have a shady spot, right? I mean, where you could...
Yeah.
So not in the direct sun.
Yeah, well, they could stand, you know, a little bit, 15 yeah. minutes, 30 minutes, you know, initially. You know, eventually, of course, they're going to be in full sun all the time, hopefully.
Right.
But this will really bring it to the fore of how important it is to harden a plant off. Because mm-hmm. not only cold, you're hardening them off to the cold, but to the, in this case, heat.
Mm-hmm.
So my plants have been, my peppers and tomatoes that are probably ready to go into the, or they're ready to go into the ground, and I very well may shade them if possible.
Well, the nice thing is, of course, that the soil temperature is warm, the plants are going to be happy in that way. But like you said, I mean, shade, I think I would definitely, certainly middle of the day through the afternoon, into the afternoon, some shade would be important on newly planted.
On newly planted, right. And, you know, a big fruit tree or something of that nature, you know, there's not much you can, not much to be done.
No, you're just going to be deafened by the noise of bees.
Yeah, if they're still blooming there. Pears seem to be pretty much done with their blooms, but the... As we mentioned, quince and apples are still,
they're going.
Yeah. My Gravenstein apple is just covered with blooms, and they're kind of a biennial producer anyway. But boy, every branch is just laden with blossoms. So,
yeah, we talked about that earlier. I think it's going to be interesting with the bees, all the bee activity and the pollination that's going on. It's a pretty happy time. And if any percentage of those flowers bear fruit, you were mentioning the next day.
Yeah.
Which is thinning.
Right. In fact, once I also posted a photo on the dirt bag program for today about the cluster of apples. This is now past the pollination stage, and they, you know, the full cluster of 7 or 8 got all pollinated. But the middle one is called the king apple, and it's generally the biggest and also has the thickest stem. And that's, when you're thinning, that's the one that you want to leave. And you take all of the other ones off. And usually I clip them off rather than peel them off, because oftentimes it'll be like a hangnail. Ooh, that just gives me the willies just thinking about it, that you pull it off and you rip part of the bud. So it's just better to clip them off mid-stem. You can leave a little bit of the stem there. There's no problem there. And I think the rule of thumb is like one apple per 200 square centimeters of leaf area. Yeah, who's going to measure that? So I tend to think about one apple every 6 inches or so.
Well, if you even just remove, if you just take off like one of those clusters, if you remove most of the apples, you'll get a larger fruit, and you'll be happier.
Indeed, there'll be fewer fruit, but the ones that remain in total volume will probably be more, and better quality, as you just mentioned.
Yeah.
And who wants to deal with, you know, hundreds of little small apples too that may be nothing. So thinning is good. The same can be said with one thing I did want to mention is what's going on in my garden is I seeded beets some weeks ago, and they're germinating now. And beets have, or are planted in what's called a compound seed, and so in each of those little dried seed pods, if you will, there'll be 1 to 4 beets that come up. And so not only should those be thinned, but the thinnings can be transplanted into the row where ones didn't come up, or they got eaten by slug or whatever. And what I typically do is, if I see a cluster of 4 healthy beet starts, I'll dig up all of them, just put my hand underneath and pull them up, or with a trowel pull them all up. And of course, the roots separate very easily. And I'll plant one back into that space, and then transplant the other 3 into another hole. So it's a great way to increase your yield with minimal effort.
What's a good time of day to do that?
Yeah, anytime it's not sunny and hot.
Yeah.
And so I think I need to do that now, but I don't know that I want to.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
I could try it probably in the evening and then water them well. And hopefully the roots will take up enough water. But, of course, they don't instantly re-root.
Yeah, shade would be something else if you do it soon.
Could, yeah, yeah. So water is going to be the important buzzword here for all of these this heat-related stuff. And with the pots, I don't know, would you move those?
Well, I've noticed over the years, you know, if you've got a pot, a black plastic pot that's out in the bright sun, it gets pretty hot on the edge of that pot. So certainly if there's if you can do it easily, you know, potted plants, if they're, depending on what they're for. I mean, if there's something decorative on your deck that's going to knock you, you know, really don't want to move it, it's big and all that, well, you can put, if, well, it's probably not, probably most people wouldn't have black plastic in that situation, but they could, and if you could put something to sort of shade the pot.
Yeah.
So it doesn't get so hot. That's the main, because it can actually burn the roots when it gets so hot on that sunny edge.
Mm-hmm. And of course they can dry out a lot, more too, since they're exposed, they're above ground.
Yep. Well, I was thinking about this yesterday, like how we, you know, plants in the ground, nature kind of takes care of them.
Yeah.
And the plants in the pots, they're your babies.
Yeah. That's the point that I made over and over last night on my presentation.
Yeah.
You know, you're responsible for...
Yeah, you're God.
So, yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, this heat whiplash, that's going to be something else for us. Okay. Well, I think we are close enough to our garden stumper. Ty, you got our garden stumper theme ready to go there? He can get it, I'm sure. We don't even have to answer last month's question because we did it live.
We got the answer on the air.
That's right. And hopefully
phenomena.
We'll get another one here too. And if you know the answer to the question that I'm going to pose after our theme song, the 503-231-8187. That's good for an answer or a question.
Yeah.
So think about that. Okay, well, this comes from the USDA. Well, a website anyway. And the question has to do with soil. Okay? According to the USDA, the only soil that is not predominantly sand, silt, or clay is called what? Okay? This is their wording on it here. It's a little tricky. The only soil that is not predominantly sand, silt, or clay is called what? Now, when we say predominantly, does that mean 50%? Yes. So none of these constitute 50% of the soil. There's a soil triangle that they put out there. And, you know, most people are probably familiar with this. Okay, if you know the answer to that, 503-231-8187.
And if you just want to call and say hi,
yes,
we'd love to hear from you too.
That's right. All right, well, let's get into dealing with weeds and grass competition.
And grass is growing in this warm weather.
Yep.
And
we've mentioned before that having a fruit, I mean, in a vegetable bed, we know you're not going to have grass growing in a vegetable bed. But oftentimes, around trees, we have grass growing. Is that a good thing? No. Jim shakes his head. So,
yeah.
So how do you recommend to do things if you're planting a tree for the first time, or if you have an existing tree that has grass?
Yeah, you know, the tendency is, it's nice, you know, to have it just, oh, I've got a nice lawn, I'll just dig a little hole, put my tree in there, and everything will just be happy. But the competition is intense, and you really, you can do various things we've talked about on the show before to reduce that problem. I mean, one first thing, of course, is to remove grass from around where you're planting a tree. And I would say a 3-foot diameter circle would be what I'd be shooting for.
Okay.
So kind of half on either side of the tree. Just remove the grass as best you can. Then the thing is to keep it from coming back. And it's not only grass but weeds. One of the ways of doing that is by using cardboard with a mulch on top. Something that, like wood or wood chips or something that kind of hold that down you want to shade. If you're doing is really shading that area, it's going to get wet, and things can grow through it, but it takes a while. And I think you've had that experience, Glenn, of doing that.
Yep. In fact, I just got a load of wood chips dumped in the driveway.
Yep.
So I'll be doing that. Let's take a break here and get to our phones here. Okay. I'm assuming we have an answer. Ty, who's up? Okay. Go ahead, caller.
I think it's loam, but it could be till.
Nope, the first one is correct. Loam is correct.
Yay.
Excellent. Right. Yes, that is the term that is used, and that's really what we're after. Loam, L-O-A-M. And
I like loam.
Yeah, don't we all, but we don't always get it, of course. So.
Powell said there was only 15% of arable land in the U.S. West.
Who said that?
John Wesley Powell.
Oh, I see. Yeah, they're probably less than when he said it, even.
I'm guessing.
Yeah. Okay, well, you, caller, what's your name?
Paul.
Paul, okay. Paul, you are entitled now to a hand tool, what am I trying to say here? Sharpening at Cully Farm Store. So this it includes pruners, loppers, shears, shovels, hose, hand tools at Tickley Farm Store in Northeast Portland at Northeast 42nd and Alberta Street. And we'll pass your information along to the proprietor, Farmer Ted, and maybe you can take advantage of that. Thanks for calling.
Very gracious. Thank you for your show.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling. Okay. So that's it, loam. That's what we want here. It's just a kind of a technical definition for what we're all striving for.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. Thank you, Jim, for allowing me to interrupt you there with that. So, we want to remove the grass. We can put mulch. I think cardboard is good to put it down because even though you remove the grass, there's still going to be some roots.
Yeah, and if you just put mulch down, like you're going to have things grow through it.
Uh huh.
And something I we use a lot of landscape fabric at the nursery because it's convenient and it's sort of a miracle fabric for us because we couldn't hire people. We just the labor of dealing with the weeds was just so much. Because we don't like to use herbicides, and we just won't do it. I mean, we're not going to use it pre-emergence and all that kind of stuff. But one thing, I made a mistake first time I used it some years ago, was I thought, well, it's typically landscape fabric is black. I thought, well, that's kind of ugly. I'm going to put some mulch on top of it.
Yeah.
So I got some straw, and I put straw on top of the landscape fabric. Well, guess what? The seeds and the straw, the roots will actually go through the landscape fabric down into the soil, even though they're very fine, but they'll do it.
Yeah.
And what a mess. I had to clean up all that. And so now the idea is we keep the area clean on top so we don't put stuff on there so we keep those weeds from
Utilitarian is a better approach there. It may look something.
Yeah.
But I can imagine. I mean, I've seen your farm out there, and, it's just, it'll go on for hundreds of feet. It's just a continuous roll, so that's very labor-saving, too.
Oh, yeah.
Just keep rolling it out.
Yeah, but now in some of the areas, and you can reuse it. I mean, we put it out for a year in one area where we're growing things, and we roll it up and use it again the next year. So.
For the home planter, though, I would still recommend cardboard, just because it's going to be good for a couple of years, probably, before it disintegrates. And by that time, hopefully, you'll have starved the grass and other weeds of light. It won't not of water. It's water and air can still pass through cardboard. So,
and the cardboard is kind of ubiquitous here.
Oh, boy.
Especially these days.
Yeah.
Your shipment from somewhere, and you've got more cardboard you can put there if you need to. So.
Yeah. So that's good if you're planting for the first time. Any other ideas if you're just planting or if you have an existing tree in the lawn?
Yeah, sort of the same idea. If the tree's been there a long time and you're happy with it and the tree seems happy, it's probably doing okay. You know,
yeah.
Once the tree gets really established, well, grass around it's not going to be such a big deal. But I remember some years ago, my son who lives in Corvallis had a fig tree planted in his parking strip. And the darn fig just struggled because the parking strip was just covered with grass, you know. But again, it was a young tree, you know, and that's when you really need to remove the competition.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's a good point there.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's move on to our second musical selection. Ty's ready for that. This is our second King here. This is Earl King. And he wrote the anthem, or certainly a standard, rock standard now, called Come On, Let the Good Times Roll. And this is Jimi Hendrix's version from Electric Ladyland.
People talking, but they just don't know what's in my heart and why I love you so. I love you, baby, like a mine of love gold. Come on, sugar, let the good time roll.
Sorry to cut Jimmy off there. That's what we do around here, though.
Well, you've got an amazing talent, Glenn. But hard, you know, you don't use it probably as well as we'd like to see. Your knowledge of music and stuff, I'm so impressed. I'd never heard that song before.
Oh, we got a caller. Okay, well, Joe, what's on your mind?
So I looked up loam, and it says a loose soil mixture of clay, sand, and silt.
Yep.
And so Mike. Question is, what about organic material? Wouldn't that be another constituent of soil?
It would be, and that's a major component of loam. When we're talking about sand, silt, and clay, these are just the mineral portions.
Right. That's what my dictionary defined loam as, was the clay, sand, and silt. It didn't say anything about organic material. So anyway, I didn't know how you define.
Yeah. Loam. Well, I think, you know, if I remember looking at the triangle correctly, and I didn't really pay a whole lot of time to mine today, but I've seen it in the past. I think that just deals strictly with the mineral content, because soil, in its, if you want to break it down into its components, really is less than 50%. Minerals. So the other 50% is air and water at various components of that. And then...
Or organic.
Well, that would be in the... If soil, and I'm kind of simplifying so I can remember it, you know, if the air and water is 50%, then the minerals is 45%, and then the organic content might be up to 5%, but very, very, very few soils can keep 5% organic matter.
Wow.
It's just hard to have that much in there because, for one, organisms use it, and the plants use it, and two, it can leach out quite easily. So these are good distinctions. But so when we talk about, well, we have sandy soil or clay soil, we're just talking about the mineral component of it.
Right.
And so I guess I just ignored it. Yeah. But thank you for bringing that up.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah. Yep. We have smart listeners, Jim.
I know. Great.
And maybe experienced gardeners, too. Right. Okay. What's next on our hit parade here, Jim? Oh, yes, our Dirtbag Dictionary term.
Dictionary, yeah.
Monetius and Dioecious.
Monetius, Dioecious. Yeah, and this was interesting because I had some dispute about this with my partner.
Gasp.
And it was, so I did some research on those terms. And it's funny, I mean, you know, most people, you might hear those terms. They really don't probably relate much to your life. But it is interesting about plants because we're always dealing with pollination and whether you have to, if you need to plant two of something or one, or sort of self fertile, all that kind of stuff. So monoecious essentially means that a plant, a given plant, has both male and female organs on that plant.
On the plant, not necessarily on the bloom?
Not necessarily on the bloom.
So, but on the plant, okay.
On the plant. So, for example, you know, like many prunus plants, I mean, all prunus have perfect flowers, peaches, apricots, plums, cherries. The flowers are perfect, meaning that the flower has both male and female parts. But they may or may not be self-fertile. It depends upon the variety. A hazelnut, for example, also has also is monoecious, but it has a male and a female flower, separate flower.
On the plant.
On that same plant. And that's monoecious. And dioecious means that you have on one plant the female flower, and another plant has the male flower. Kiwi would be an example.
Uh-huh.
A good example. Uh-huh. Strawberry. Same thing.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so what are apples, for example?
Apples are monoecious because they have perfect flowers.
But they still need another
pollinator. They need a
pollinator. They need a pollinizer too, yeah. Which is the insect. That...
Yeah, but
yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. What is that, Glenn? So I would, you know, I can't remember that, you know, the pollinator probably is the insect.
Yeah, yeah. And then the pollinizer supplies the needed pollen.
For the insect to move around.
Yeah, or maybe it's opposite. Just one of those.
I bet a listener might know this. Maybe we have a.
Yeah, somebody's going to call in and say, you dingle bats.
That's right.
Yeah.
PhD in horticulture or something. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, but anyway, that's monoecious, and there was some debate in the family.
Resolved it. What was the other idea?
That a plant with a perfect flower would not be monoecious, but then what is it?
Uh-huh.
And there was no answer for that. So that's but basically that's the two classes of flowering plants, monoecious and dioecious.
Okay. That's good that we have this dictionary to talk about a little bit.
Well, you know, it's really important, you know, when we talk about, I mean, like when I was doing retail nursery work, I mean, it was a question that came up all the time. You know, what do I need to do? You know, what do I need?
Yeah.
Two different varieties, or do you know, have a male and female? How many males? How many will pollinate? You know,
yeah.
How many males to these females and all that sort of thing. So,
well, it's important.
It's very important. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, Ty, let's go back to the phones. Arthur, good morning.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. I hate to beat a dead horse, but what is the difference between humus and loam?
Humus is the end result of fully composted material.
Okay.
And it kind of resists breakdown further, and yet it's a good component in the soil. So when you're adding compost, you're adding compost and not humus, because there's still some... a little bit of breakdown that can go, and that is to say, breakdown meaning there's food for the microorganisms that are in the soil.
Right. Right. And what's and so what is loam?
Loam is just the, not just, it's the mineral composition of your soil. And so we'll say that of the 45% of soil that is mineral content, that would be equally distributed, or, and according to the USDA, none of them is predominant. So you might say there's a third each of sand, silt, and clay.
Oh, so it's a good mix of things,
yes.
Including humus.
Well, humus doesn't really, it doesn't figure into the mineral content designation of a soil.
Ah, I see.
It's more
so
sterile.
It's a living, it has, the humus has, is food for the creatures, more available food for those tiny creatures, or?
Well, since humus is pretty much already broken down, it doesn't really act as that, but it retains moisture. It provides some stability there, structure for the actual structure of the soil. So it's an excellent thing to have, but we'll say that the mineral content is what we might call dirt. And when and when you add humus and organic matter and air and water, then we have soil.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks for hammering at us till we get it.
the horse is still alive.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was, yeah. So hopefully that's helpful. Okay, any other calls there, Ty? Lee, did you say? Yes,
congrats,
Lee.
For the beating.
What was that? Lee.
Hi.
Lee.
Yeah, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Well, I'm here. I like to consider the term soil organic content, abbreviated SOC. And I heard about it a couple of years ago when I read an article that said if you add 1%, if you increase soil organic content 1% over an acre, it will hold an additional 60,000 gallons of water.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me.
Okay.
Although I don't know what optimum is. I mean, that doesn't sound like it's too much.
Well, you can basically, it's a range, soil organic content is a range from zero to more or less 100%, because peat is a soil, they consider it a soil, and it is basically 100% organic material.
Yeah, but we know not much grows in it.
Not that we eat.
Right, in bogs and things like that. Not that I've ever been around a bog.
Oh, they're like pretty that, neat. They bounce.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can believe it. I mean, because it's all, well, not all, mostly organic matter.
But, you know, you okay. said that 5% was maximum.
Well, yeah, and is it possible to have too much? I would argue it is, and
it's
I've done
peat.
Well, or just organic matter. And if I've done experiments by starting seeds in 100% compost versus half and half compost and soil or a soilless mix or something like that. And while, of course, the seed can germinate, it can germinate in anything, the compost really doesn't offer enough structure, and it dries out so quickly if it's just compost that it's not a good planting medium.
Well, commercial farming has really destroyed, and destruction of wetlands has really destroyed the organic content in a lot of soils, and hence the its ability to hold moisture when it rains, so flood intensity is increased.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks, Lee. Good comments. Bye. Okay. Ty, are we done with the calls here? Okay. On with the show then, Jim. We talked about monoecious. Okay, kiwis. Speaking of kiwis there, what do we want to say about, I mean, they should already be trellised, but if they're not.
Yeah, and kiwis are a fun subject. I started growing them a long, long time ago, and discovered some things about them that I'm sure many of the listeners probably already know, but for instance, a fuzzy kiwi, which is the kind we typically buy in a store, a female vine can bear 100 pounds or more of fruit.
Yeah.
That's a lot of weight.
Yeah, a little tiny tomato cage ain't going to cut it.
No. Some string. With, you know, bamboo stakes.
Yeah.
Do it either. So,
yeah.
So that, for a fuzzy kiwi, and the hard, what we call a hardy kiwi, some people call them kiwi berries, or the one that has the fruit that doesn't, it's not fuzzy, but it's smaller, but very, very good.
Yeah. In fact, I prefer those.
They can get a lot of, they can get pretty heavy, too. And so, I imagine there's probably a listener out there who, like myself, discovered that the smaller, that you need some substance to your structure for that. And how you do that, a lot of folks, you know, if you have these kiwis in your backyard, the kind of thing you would use in a commercial planting kind of trellis wouldn't be appropriate. It's just, the main thing is that you're using cross members, 2x6s and 4x4, at least posts going up, and typically people use wire, but you don't have to. But you know, that works out pretty well to put the vine on. I mean, it's hard to describe exactly on the air about how a kiwi trellis could look, but it just needs something that 6 feet wide would be sort of a guideline for a kiwi plant.
How tall?
Well, if you want it to get underneath it, then you need to be whatever, you know, six and a half feet above the ground. Then typically the fruit will hang down. You can pick it still, you know. But I always made mine tall enough to go get underneath them.
Yeah.
And well, for both those kinds, there's a third type of kiwi which we actually named Arctic Beauty kiwi, Actinidia colomicta, that's not so vigorous. And it doesn't bear so much fruit, and it actually likes some shade. And that plant is very beautiful right now.
Yes.
Not only are the blooms on our apple trees beautiful, but the foliage on our female Arctic Beauties is striking this year. But but it doesn't need nearly as heavy a duty a trellis as the others do.
I had a question when you mentioned the wire that the vine is going to be attached to. How do you recommend attaching it to the wire?
Well,
or even to the vertical posts.
Yeah. So typically, if kiwi, when you have a main trunk, and you let that grow up, and you cut it back, but it gets above the post that you're your trellis, and let some of the lower buds, a couple of them, grow out to become the side arms, so to speak.
Okay.
Other words for that, And then that kind of makes the permanent structure of the plant, and then the shoots grow off of that main structure, and then the shoots themselves can become part of the main structure too, going out to the side. So it looks kind of like a back with ribs. And there's really not usually any need to tie anything, because the plant itself will just come out and lay on the wire. We don't normally have to do anything as far as attaching stuff. It just, you know.
And that wire, excuse me, the branches that lay on the wire will be cut off every year.
That's right.
In the spring, to make way for the new growth.
Yep, because kiwis bear fruit on growth that comes off last year's wood.
Mm-hmm.
And so typically, and this is, I'm sure there'll be listeners that have, you know, they get pretty wild, and it's amazing to see how fast they can grow. But if you've got an 8-10 foot shoot coming out, you cut that back to 3 to 4 feet, and then the shoots that grow that in the fall, in the winter, the shoots that grow off that will then become the new fruiting shoots, the fruiting wood.
And is it past time to doing that pruning?
Yeah, okay.
I
like doing it by the very latest, would be mid-February.
Oh, okay.
Because then the plant starts to grow, and they bleed a lot. And
yeah.
So other people say, oh, it's no big deal if it bleeds, but I don't like that.
You don't like it?
No.
Well, this is good information to have then for planning. If you need to trellis your kiwi, or you're going to acquire kiwi, get the trellis in place first.
Yeah, think about the space, because a male and female kiwi plant should have a minimum of 12 feet by 6 feet wide. And that's with pruning. You're going to be doing some pruning with that eventually. Bigger would even be better.
All right.
The male doesn't need as much pruning in some ways as the female because it's not bearing fruit. But it still can get quite large, and pruning is more fruit on it just to keep it sort of in balance.
In the final analysis, or at the final pruning stage, how much more female should you leave than male?
Well,
75 to 25?
Yeah, sure. The male is only there for its flowers. You got to make sure you don't prune it back so hard you cut off all the wood that's going to make the flowers, because it's the same as the female. It makes the flowers off of the wood that grows off last year's wood. So if you were to cut it back so hard you took off all of last year's wood, you wouldn't get any flowers.
Uh-huh.
But you don't really need very many. A fourth of the space for the male is plenty.
Okay, that's enough flowering.
Yep.
Flowers.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Well, we're about out of time. Jim, anything else going on there? What was your assessment of the public transportation? It was their first time in after 3 years.
Yes, it was. As you know, my eyesight's not so great, so I was a little concerned about it. The one thing that happened was sort of odd. I got the bus from Oregon City to the Milwaukee Transit Center, where the MAX.
Yes.
Starts. And there were two trains there, both of them with their doors open. And I didn't know. I thought, well, I just, when I got on one, and that was not the one that left. I was standing there watching the train go away.
Uh-oh.
So I've got to do more questioning, obviously.
I see. But you still made it. You were plenty early.
Oh, yeah. I got down to OMSI at a little before 10 and walked, had a nice walk. Here.
Yeah, and I'll just pass along too, just that you have lunch date set with one or two of your brothers.
After this.
So that's you have many reasons to come in. We appreciate you making the effort.
Oh well,
that was good.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, I'll make one comment. I brought my bike in, and as I was crossing Burnside, it's a bike crossing, and so a TriMet bus stopped in the nearest lane, but I was kind of shielded then from the furthest lane, and he honked because there was another car. They honked because there was another car approaching quickly in my blind spot.
Uh-huh.
So I was appreciative that I think the car did slow down then.
Yeah.
But I just appreciated that part. So shout out to TriMet.
Well, and the bus 33 driver that I was on from Oregon City this morning, very nice person. She was like helpful to me, and I gave her one of my flyers. Hey, here's some information on Oregon.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you, Jim, for coming in. It's a pleasure as always. We'll end our look at the Three Kings here with another of my favorite songwriters, this being Carole King. Yes, award winner, national award winner, and just simple hooks, but she's been writing tunes for 50 years. And this is a pretty early one from, not done by Carole King, but covered by Charles Earland on organ. This is called Will You Love Me Tomorrow? So, thanks for listening to The Dirtbag. See you next month. I'm gonna go get some more.
Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy miércoles 10 de mayo del 2023. La emergencia pública mundial causada por el COVID-19 puede haber terminado oficialmente, pero la pandemia seguirá con nosotros por muchos años. Tampoco está claro que los gobiernos hayan aprendido lo suficiente del brote como para estar preparados para luchar contra los nuevos microbios emergentes que podrían desencadenar calamidades peores. Estas son las crudas conclusiones de los científicos que reaccionaron a la noticia de la semana pasada de que la Organización Mundial de la Salud